Well, welcome back. We'll now proceed with our reflections on human rights and spiritual responsibilities. And some of you might be interested to know that we'll be joining the World Goodwill meetings that are taking place today in Geneva and New York on the same subject. So there's quite a thought form being built today on this subject. It's now a great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Adam Parsons. Adam is the editor for Share the World's Resources, a non-profit organization based in London that promotes the international sharing of essential resources such as food, water, and energy through the agency of the United Nations. Adam's background is as a journalist on the national newspapers, and he's traveled extensively in developing countries. He is also the author of a forthcoming book based on his experiences and research of one of the largest slums in sub-Saharan Africa called Kibera. Share the World Resources has recently published an in-depth report on the current food crisis, and it will also be releasing a report on human rights and the concept of international sharing to coincide with the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in December. So we look forward to hearing what he has to say on sharing to secure human rights, democracy in action. Thanks, Sam.
Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me to speak today on behalf of Share the World's Resources. And what I hope to offer is a complementary but perhaps a slightly different perspective on this crucial subject of human rights and democracy. Although I won't be speaking in spiritual terms, the theme of this talk, and indeed our organization, which is encapsulated indeed in our name, goes to the very heart of spiritual teachings and all of the religions of the world. And the case I'd like to make is simply this, that the interlinked crises facing the world today are focused in the political and economic structures of society. And it requires a transformation in how we distribute resources and in our global governance frameworks if we are ever to secure human rights universally or achieve any measure of true democracy. The impasse in world affairs which we see today requires a complete reordering of global priorities and a fairer sharing of the world's resources. When it comes to human rights, no one can escape the disparity between the rich countries, like here in the UK, and the rights we enjoy, like the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to education, and the daily infringement of these basic human rights in many of the developing countries. Of those, the four freedoms that were articulated by Roosevelt in 1941, the freedom from want is still a dream for almost half of the world population. The rights framework, one of the strengths of the rights framework, is that it carries with it the presumption of an eventual mechanism for enforcement. But there is still no concerted international plan for how to achieve this. For us as an organization, we take this as the starting point. What is the international mechanism required to secure basic human needs universally as a human right? And not at any time in the future, but immediately. When we're talking about these vast problems of humanity in this way, I think it helps to look at the issues in a very basic context. So if I may spell out the most fundamental questions. Firstly, is it possible to secure human rights universally? Again, not in the future, but immediately. And secondly, what do we mean by democracy? And is it possible to secure democratic freedoms universally? Again, not in the future, but immediately. And thirdly, if this is possible, then why has the international community not achieved this noble goal since these ideals were first enshrined in 1948? And how do we begin to go about doing this? I'm only going to speak for about 20 minutes, so I better speak quickly. But in a world of democratic global governance, perhaps these rights were most concisely expressed in that landmark document, the Universal Declaration. Article 25 of which states that everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate to the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing and medical care and necessary social services. When the United Nations marks the 60th anniversary of these rights on December the 10th, in many ways there will be little to celebrate. We live in a time defined by the most dissolute world records. There are more billionaires today than ever before. There are now 1,125 billionaires, breaking the 1,000 mark for the first time. There are more millionaires today than ever before. Adding an extra zero to the equation, there are now 10.1 million millionaires. There's also more city dwellers today than ever before. And the number of slum dwellers worldwide has just broken the 1 billion mark for the first time. We've also seen this summer record harvests in all of the BRIC economies, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and record cereal crops in the United States, producing more food than we have ever done before. And yet the number of hungry people has increased 100 million this year, reaching close to 1 billion people altogether. Again, another world record. So it's an age of the most crude paradoxes. Unbelievable wealth amidst unbelievable penury. Record levels of food amidst record levels of hunger. And this paradox of rising economic growth alongside rising levels of poverty. To simplify, what this indicates is that there's more than enough wealth to go around. There's enough food to feed everyone sufficiently. And there's enough resources for everyone to at least enjoy a minimal standard of living. The problem in its simplest form is one of equity and distribution. We do not use the resources that we have wisely, and we do not share those world's resources with those who need them most. The world problem in its essence is so simple that a child could both understand it and comprehend its absurdity. These distorted global priorities became most, this bias in global priorities became most palpably clear during the recent financial crash. And people everywhere began asking, why is it that governments can summon several trillion dollars to bail out millionaire bankers, and yet we cannot find the $30 billion a year, which is all it would take to bail out the world's hungry? A superficial answer to this question is straightforward. We can say that the market responds to money. It doesn't respond to basic needs. But to understand why the economy is structured in this way requires an appreciation of the ideology that has underlined economic thinking over the past few decades. We could fill the walls of this hall probably with the critiques of this economic philosophy, and the names given to it are legion. It's been called laissez-faire economics, market fundamentalism, corporatism, or more commonly neoliberalism, or simply economic globalization. What it comes down to is this belief in the total liberation of corporations, the elimination of the public sphere, the prioritizing of profit over all other human values, and this fixed notion that markets are self-correcting, that they allocate resources efficiently, and that they serve the public interest well. One of the chief ideologues of this belief system was, of course, Milton Friedman, the late Milton Friedman, economics guru to world leaders from Thatcher and Reagan to the current Bush government. And according to Friedman, market forces are like an infallible force of nature. And when left to their own devices and without any interference from governments or policymakers, they will lead to a perfectly balanced society with full employment, boundless creativity, and zero inflation. The most eloquent proponents of this belief system argued that everyone will benefit from this reliance on market forces, that wealth will trickle down to the poor, that inequality will eventually equilibrate through widespread economic growth, and that climate change will eventually be mitigated through business efficiency and technical innovations. Since the 1980s, this philosophy has been adopted by political parties of not just the traditional left, but also the center and the center right, of course. Another term for it could be capitalism with the gloves off. This era that we have seen where business forces have become stronger and more aggressive with less opposition than ever before. The loudest message of this belief system is, or this dogmatic devotion to markets, is that there is no alternative, and that we have reached the end of history, the end of mankind's ideological evolution. So it's in this context that we can talk about human rights and democracy. As Friedman put it in his classic book, Capitalism and Freedom, profit-making is the essence of democracy. From the neoliberal point of view, if any government interferes with the workings of the market through redistributing wealth, for example, they are being inherently anti-democratic. So the role of governments is best restricted to the job of protecting private property and should not be concerned with public welfare, which should be left in the hands of the private sector. The official version of history of the past few decades, as told by the business press and the major world powers, is that the triumph of deregulated markets has been born of freedom. And unfettered free markets go hand in hand with democracy. So the acme of this belief has been seen recently in the war on terror, and the almost every action by the US troops being accompanied since 2003 by President Bush's standard boilerplates about freedom and democracy. The reality as seen today is somewhat different from this dominant narrative. Under a free market system that glorifies wealth and prioritizes profit, governments have actually become bigger than ever, but only to work primarily on behalf of corporate interests and commercial values. And every country where this belief system has taken root, not least in the United Kingdom, what we have actually seen is the emergence of a powerful ruling alliance between a few large corporations and a class of mostly wealthy politicians. Far from the market being freed from the state, as in Milton Friedman's utopian vision, what we have actually seen is the merging of the corporate and political spheres in the cause of appropriating the world's resources, which were previously held in the public domain. A necessary byproduct of this leadership, this political leadership that fails to represent the majority interest, is of course seen in low turnouts to major elections. Far from a democratic involvement in human affairs, what we've actually seen is an increasing apathy, cynicism, and a depoliticized citizenry. So this is a very perverse understanding of democracy, historically linked to human rights abuses more than the securing of basic human rights, as notoriously seen in the overthrowing of the Allende government in Chile, or the military dictatorship in Argentina, or the transition to capitalism in Poland and Russia, or as in this ongoing example of Iraq. As the political writer Noam Chomsky has so famously often said, democracy is promoted and supported by the world's major powers if and only if it conforms to strategic and economic objectives. The most outstanding result of this political economic arrangement has been a huge transfer of wealth into private hands and an ever-widening chasm between the inconceivably rich and the disposable poor. In December 2006, just a month after Milton Friedman died, the United Nations did a study which showed that the richest 2% of adults own more than a half of global household wealth. In most countries for which we have data, the top 1% of income earners have received a rapidly growing and hugely disproportionate share of national income. The figures show that income distribution has become more equal since about 1980, when this globalist ideology, whatever we may call it, infiltrated world affairs. Today, barely a week goes by without some high-level report being released about growing inequality, increasing destabilization and insecurity, and rising poverty and hunger. So if we ask the question, has this economic system been successful in securing human rights and enabling democracy? The actual answer is, it depends on your perspective. If you measure progress in terms only of financial wealth, profits, and growth that benefits only the very few, then the world has done very well over the past 30 years. Since the 1990s, the business press almost ran out of adjectives to describe how well this booming economy was doing in the emerging and the advanced economies. But in contrast, if your indicators of progress are human well-being, are the health of the environment, or the lives of those most in need, then the world is facing a catastrophe of unbelievable extent. It's almost as if the world can be divided into these two broad camps. On one side, there's this belief in profits over all other values. And this other camp, citizens' movements and men and women of goodwill have perceived that the power to govern has shifted from the public towards global corporations. And corporations now dominate government through lobbying activities. And yet, even though they are the most important segment of society, they remain excluded from public control and work in conjunction with international governance institutions which deny the democratic rights of the majority world. What we have seen through the leadership of civilization through the prism of economics, as one commentator put it, is actually a paradox in which the short-sighted financial imperatives that are driving world affairs are incompatible with the immediate needs of the most impoverished, with the welfare of future generations, and the longer-term sustainability of planet Earth. Now, all of this is bad news. Men and women of goodwill have long recognized the blindness, the injustice, and the unsustainability of the current economic system, and have simultaneously hailed a vision of a better world, which has a true form of democracy in which universal rights can be universally secured. Just as the names for the current economic ideology are legion, the names for this truer form of democracy are numerous also. It's been called economic democracy, living democracy, earth democracy, democratic mondialization, also globalization, with numerous component offshoots like water democracy, food sovereignty. To all of these ideas, there's basically two common themes, which are economic self-reliance and local self-determination. It involves not merely the institutions and the multiple parties of political democracy, but a world in which everyone has a say in their own future.